Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. Today is my birthday, and I am going to give all of you a present on today's American Dissident Voices broadcast. I have, again, leveraged the power of artificial intelligence and my own personal friendship with the author to create a spoken version in the voice of Dr. Revelo Pendleton Oliver himself, of a brilliant example of Dr. Oliver's writings, which was never before available in audio form. His Reflections on the Christ Myth, nominally a review of Nicholas Carter's Christ Myth book, but really a vastly important work in its own right. This will take several broadcasts to complete, and we may interrupt it to discuss important current events, but we will complete it in a reasonable period of time. There is no more important question before us than religion, and no more important aspect of religion than the tragic fact that white people have, to a ruinous extent, abandoned their own philosophical and religious traditions and accepted a religion devised by our most dangerous enemies. Our race's desperate plight cannot be addressed so long as we do not understand this basic fact. And no one can educate us on this matter better than my friend and mentor, Dr. Oliver. And so, we present part one of Reflections on the Christ Myth. Listen.
Christianity is a fusion of two myths. The Jesus myth requires no explication. It is clear that the stories collected in the New Testament are versions of a folktale formed, like the legend of Robin Hood, by the accretion around a central figure of episodes in the careers of a number of minor figures. The Jesus of that legend was a composite formed from tales about Jesus ben Ananias, Jesus ben Pandera, the agitator whose name may have been Jesus, who led a party of his followers into Jerusalem during the celebration of the Passover and was well received by the populace but soon suppressed, and Judas the Gaulonite. And it is possible, of course, that there was an otherwise forgotten Jesus who also tried to start a Jewish revolt against civilized rule and paid the penalty. The composite Jesus was, of course, a would-be Christ and interested only in his own barbarous people. The stories in the New Testament have been embellished by Christians, and that is what is remarkable. The Christ myth is puzzling, an historical problem that is still unsolved. Indeed, if considered a priori as an historical phenomenon, it is astounding. The Jesus of the composite legend was a would-be Christ who anticipates the basic doctrine of the Talmud, that Jews are a unique form of life, vastly superior to all other peoples, who at best, if totally submissive to God's people, may aspire to the status of dogs. He boasts that he brings not peace, but a sword. So, he probably wanted to rouse the Jews scattered throughout the world, as well as those in Palestine, to start slaughtering the civilized peoples, as did his successors in the great Jewish conspiracy of 117. Yet, this implacable enemy of the Aryans was transformed by the Christ myth into a god that Aryans worshipped. The Jews, naturally and from their standpoint, reasonably, hate all Aryans, but they feel especially intense hatred for Aryans, who are so intelligent and manly that they resent being herded and fleeced by their Jewish shepherds and refuse to believe in the enormous racial superiority that entitles Jews to own the entire planet. When the Germans tried to have a country of their own, international Jewry sent against Germany their stupid British hounds, and eventually their rabid American mastiffs, who obediently and foully murdered the German leaders to prove to the world that resistance to God's people is an unforgivable sin that is punished by torture and death. That we all know. Now, if in the coming century, say by the year 2100, the Jews begin to venerate Hermann Göring or Alfred Rosenberg or Julius Streicher as their divinely inspired savior and worship him as a son of God and an incarnation of their Yahweh, that would be astounding, wouldn't it? Yes, but not more incredible than the transformation of a Jewish Christ into a savior of Aryans and a god. It is to solve this historical paradox that Nicholas Carter has written the Christ myth. Mr. Carter will be remembered for his excellent book, the late great book, The Bible, in which he reached and enforced the conclusion that, quote, the establishment of Christianity in the West represents one of the greatest tragedies that has ever befallen the human race, end quote. He persuasively finds the key to the paradoxical enigma in the effect of Greek civilization on the barbarous Jews. It will be necessary, therefore, to begin with the 6th century BC. As we all know, Cyrus the Great, the founder of the Persian Empire, showed great favor to the Jews, probably to recompense their work in subverting the Babylonian Empire and betraying the city of Babylon into his hands. The Jews so needed his protection that they flattered him by calling him their Christ, i.e., a being divinely sent and inspired by Yah to save his people. Soon after 538 BC, Cyrus rewarded them, as the British were to do much later, by giving them permission to take over for themselves a part of Palestine. Soon after they were established in Jerusalem, a contingent of wealthy Jews from Babylon undertook a drastic reformation of their tribal religion. They eliminated their goddess and three other gods and recognized Yah, or Yahu, a god they had taken over from the Canaanites as the patron god of their race. The special protection of the Jews by Cyrus was continued by his successors until the Persian Empire was conquered by Alexander the Great. That was a truly epical event. The entire Near and Middle East was transformed. The vast and incontestable superiority of the world's first rational civilization, made evident to all by its invincible military power, was apparent to all the diverse populations of those lands. The Greeks built cities that were the focus of a truly great and rational culture. Everyone above the peasantry sedulously imitated Greek customs, including athletic contests and games. The conquered populations hastened to learn as much Greek as they could, and Aramaic, the Semitic language that had been the lingua franca of the Orient and used even by the Persians as the language of administration, became a vulgar and despised dialect, used only by the lowest and most ignorant classes. Even the Jews, whose language was Aramaic, Hebrew was known only to the more learned members of the priesthood, were affected by their forced exposure to civilization. Jews who had any capacity for assimilating or simulating culture learned Greek and usually changed their Canaanite names for distinctively Greek names by a kind of fixed conversion. E.g., a man named Jesus called himself Jason by allusion to the famous Argonaut, and Matthew became Menelaus in honor of the celebrated husband of Helen. The names of cities were likewise changed, e.g., Amora became Areopolis, and Akko became Ptolemais. Even in the temple at Jerusalem, the signs regulating admission to the sanctuary were written in Greek. This process of real or simulated conversion to civilization was facilitated by the fact that the Jews continued to enjoy under Alexander and the Diadochi who succeeded him the privileges they had been given by the Persians. The Jewish Encyclopedia admits that, quote, Alexander and the first Ptolemies and Seleucids treated their Jewish subjects with much benevolence, end quote. What Christians call the Old Testament, including books and parts of books that are omitted in most Bibles, originally written in Hebrew and Aramaic, had to be translated into Greek for the benefit of Jews who could not read Aramaic, which had once been their native tongue. The result was the Septuagint, which takes its name from a typical Jewish forgery, the letter concocted in the name of Aristeus, supposedly a Greek who could not write really correct Greek, which certifies that the Septuagint was directly inspired, or rather dictated, by Yah himself, whose name may have been by that time Judaized by changing it to Yahweh. Educated Jews, wishing to make their tribe respectable in the eyes of civilized men, followed their racial proclivity and invented sons of Abraham, who had been companions of Hercules and descendants of Isaac, who had sailed with the Argonauts. Later, growing bolder, they identified Moses with Musaeus, the mythical son of Orpheus, or of Linus, the mythical inventor of systaltic music, who lived long before Homer wrote didactic verse and hymns, and, being a divinely gifted seer, like Tiresias, left a collection of oracular utterances. To a modern reader, this will seem to be mere trifling, but when Jews identified their Yahweh with Zeus, the consequences changed history. Somewhere along the line, Zeus was identified with the Zeus of Clenthes' hymn, i.e., God in the Christian misuse of that word. He was the god of Stoic monotheism, also called Providence and the Mind of the Universe, Animus Mundi. That converted Yahweh from a tribal deity who fought for his race and overcame the gods of other nations into the unique and supreme God of the universe. That was an arrogant claim that altered Jewish consciousness and was maintained even by the Jews who most resented civilization and returned to their primitive barbarism. With even greater effrontery, educated Jews began to claim that one or another aspect of civilization was of Jewish origin. They had learned the method of allegorical interpretation from the Stoics and by outrageously twisting the texts of their sacred books in Greek translation. They proved their point with the facility of a shyster lawyer. This impudent hoaxing reached its fullest development with a supposed Jewish philosopher, Aristobulus, who, circa 150 BC, brazenly claimed that the philosophy of Aristotle, and indeed the whole of Greek culture, was derived from the Old Testament. He naturally forged some Greek verse, purportedly from early Greek poets, to prove some of his points. A far more moderate and intelligent practitioner of the allegorical method was Philo Judaeus, circa 20 BC to circa AD 50, on whom Mr. Carter concentrates his attention. Although his enemies may have exaggerated when they claimed that he did not know a word of Aramaic, to say nothing of Hebrew, it is true that all his knowledge of the Jews' holy books came from the Septuagint. He was a learned man, and if I am not mistaken, acquired a command of Greek that no other Jewish author ever attained. We especially remember Philo for his candid admission that the tale in the Old Testament about an armed conquest of Palestine led by Jesus, alias Joshua, is preposterous, and that what must have happened is that the Canaanites, their minds muddled by old Yahweh, admitted the Jews to their country as eminently pious refugees and permitted the immigrants to organize their synagogues and flourish until they were ready to take over the country of their enemies. For the Jews considered the foolish Canaanites as their enemies and entered Canaan intending to kill or enslave their stupid hosts as soon as they had sufficiently penetrated the fool's country. American boobs will soon learn that the barbarians never change their tactics or their nature. We should also remember Philo for his formulation of the one-world hokum that is now so widely used as sucker bait for dim-witted Aryans. He affirmed that the divine plan arranges the rise and fall of nations, quote, to the end that the whole of our world should be as a single state, enjoying that best of constitutions, democracy, end quote. Philo was a well-educated and learned man, admirably well-versed in Greek literature and philosophy, and Mr. Carter rightly takes him as a model of Hellenized Jews, all of whom he lumps together as the Letzim. But we must remember that he remained a Jew. You cannot read very far in Philo's rather copious writings without becoming aware of an alien mentality. He had, as I have said, a good command of the noble language. But when he writes certain Greek words and their derivatives, he does not mean what the words mean in respectable Greek. To the rational Greek, Aryan mind, truth is something that can and must be objectively determined. It denotes veracity as opposed to lying, facts as opposed to fancies, reality as opposed to illusory appearances. Truth is factual and must be determined by observation and reason. For Philo, however, truth is what he thinks Yahweh said in the scriptures he wrote and what he therefore wants. Truth for Philo is not what is, but what ought to be. It is the Jewish religion, as he understands it, after revising it with his allegorical interpretations. It is faith, and therefore irrational. There can be no greater antithesis than between the Greeks' rational and objective truth and the truth of unreason, as Bertrand Russell aptly termed faith in religions. Fictions about supernatural beings that soothe and comfort weaklings who are afraid to contemplate the grim world of reality. Philo was really uninterested in truth, as the Greeks and all rational men conceive it. Since Philo constantly tries to equate his religion to Stoicism, you should particularly notice that no Stoic would ever have countenanced his faith in the quote-unquote truth of unreason.